or the Ombudsman. The deal with Cadogan House. The deal with... Oh, he said, realization hitting him. Cadogan House is supposed to stay out of it. That's the theory. We talked to Yoon after the event, and he had the same thought you did, that maybe the fading magic has them concerned. I shook my head. I don't know. I've been out of the loop for 4 years. Maybe I'm just trying to adjust to the new sup order.
You look different, he said,
and I thought I saw appreciation in his eyes.
Still a vampire, of course, but different.
Thanks for the evaluation. His thoughtful expression didn't change.
You look happy.
The comment, so unsnarky, threw me off a little. I am.
Did you find what you were looking for in Paris?
Another question that sounded legitimate, like he was actually interested in my feelings. The answer, of course, was both simple and complicated. I lived, ate, slept. I walked cobblestone streets and tried macarons of every color, all of them equally gross, and no one knew who I was. For the first time in my life, I could figure that out, who I was, without an audience. I got to be myself, I said after a moment.
And who was that?
Elisa Sullivan, I said, meeting his gaze again. Not the daughter of someone else, not the first child. In France, they didn't care who I was. His brows lifted.
And here they cared too much?
You know how it was. I didn't want to get into that with him, so I changed the subject. The wine, women, and song seem to have agreed with you. He grinned.
Wine, women, and song agree with a lot of people.
I snorted. That's why there's a trail of broken-hearted shifters behind you.
Yours may be vampires, he said with a crooked grin, but they're just as broken-hearted. Are you staying in Chicago?
He asked before I could contradict him. I shook my head. Heading back after the talks. I have 9 months left of service, and then we'll see.
We're leaving for Alaska in a few days.
The North American Central Pack was headquartered in Memphis, where the Keene family was originally from. But Aurora, Alaska was the spiritual home of all the North American shifter packs. The pack's going back to Aurora?
Not the entire pack. Just a group. I'm leading it. We're doing well financially, but we're feeling a little bruised after being in Chicago for so long. This city doesn't recharge us. There's too much steel, too much concrete, and too many people. The magic is diffuse. In Alaska, the magic is everywhere.
That must have been what Berna was talking about. I lifted a brow. Is this about running around naked in the woods?
That's don't ask, don't tell. And no. This is about feeling better, about healing. Our magic is worn down, literally. Scraped raw because we've been going, doing, fighting for so long. We aren't as strong. We don't heal as fast, even when we shift.
There was concern in his tone, and I realized he actually looked stressed. Connor had always seemed content to play the prince, having the prestige of the throne without actually having to worry about the job. Maybe he was taking that more seriously, too. That sounds serious, I said.
It is. The trip's necessary. So the pack will ride, and be prepared to fight.
I imagined a convoy of shifters in leather jackets, long hair streaming in the wind. Then I realized what he'd said. Wait, to fight what? Road rash and sunburn?
There are conversations the pack needs to have with subs outside Chicago's city limit. Incidents that need to be dealt with in person. Those conversations are necessary, but they aren't with allies, and some will take place in enemy territory.
He gestured to Thelma.
But there are upsides.
Then I'll let you get back to it. Thanks for the time, and good luck with Thelma.
Thanks. Maybe I'll bring her out tonight. Give your fanged people a thrill.
I glanced back.
My fanged people? The Cadogan House party. I'm expected to put in an appearance.
Ah, maybe encourage your friends to skip the leather.
Shifters will be shifters, he said with a grin. And it is a formal occasion.
As I walked back through the building toward the waiting auto, I realized it was probably the longest real conversation I'd ever had with Connor Keene. Back to the hotel, and it would soon be time to get dressed and prepare for the next round of service to Dumas, for the party, and for Cadogan House. But before that, I needed a break. Too many supernaturals and too much magic had me on edge, was wearing down the edges of my immunity against the monster. My hand had shaken when I'd pushed the button on the elevator, and I'd clenched my fingers into a fist so the humans I'd shared it with didn't think I was about to attack. I checked in with Sari to confirm everyone was on schedule, then changed into leggings and a tank, and sat down on the floor to stretch. It had taken me a few years to find nighttime yoga classes that I liked and that gave me what I didn't know I'd needed. Focus. Vinyasa, which focused on breath and flow from one pose to the next, worked for me. The practice made me stronger, more limber, and it helped me keep myself and the monster in check. Still on the floor, draped so my nose touched my knees, I closed my eyes, waited for my limbs to warm, to loosen. The drumming came suddenly, a warning played out in throbbing magic, and I fought it, sweat glistening over skin as I pushed against the intrusion. I began to move into poses, some in which my body was stretched, some in which my body was compressed. That required fluidity as I shifted from one pose to another, the movements between as precise as the poses themselves, as that was the hallmark of vinyasa. An hour later, I was sweaty and exhausted, but my mind was quiet, and the drumming had stopped. For now. The snack and shower that followed had me nearly back at 100%. I dressed, fancying myself up in the way of vampires. Physically, I was turned out pretty well. My dress, found at a Paris consignment shop, was the color of emeralds, a sheath of bias-cut silk from the narrow halter-style top to the floor-skimming hem. It looked like the dress of a heroine from a 1940s mystery, worn to a fancy party where she'd pull a tiny, pearl-handled gun from her purse. I paired the dress with strappy sandals in a metal that was halfway between silver and gold, and opted to pin my hair back into a knot, leaving a few waves loose around my face. I liked feeling the weight of it on my shoulders, familiar, and almost like a cape of my own. But this dress deserved something more. When I was assembled, my clutch and katana scabbard in hand, I locked up and headed to Sari's room. The guards at the door checked my identification, nodded, and let me in. Sari stood in the middle of the room on a flat box, while Odette, on her knees with a pin in her mouth, worked at the hem of Sari's gown. If my dress was old-school American glamour, Sari's was French avant-garde. The skirt was long and straight, with a slit in the front that rose to the top of her thighs. There was a navel-bearing bodice with mesh sleeves that started below her shoulders, leaving them bare. Her hair was piled up in a complicated braid around a silver diadem, and the same black mesh reached from the bottom of the band to the top edges of her sleeves, enclosing her face in a strange, cocooning veil. Her earrings were drops of diamonds long enough to brush the tops of her shoulders,
and her eyes were dark and smoky. "Lise," she said, pressing her hands together with excitement. "You look exquisite. What do you think of these?"
"It's amazing," I said, and walked closer, then around her. The fabric shimmered with even the slightest movement, so it looked like Sari had been draped in a starlit night.
"I am so glad we decided on the green," she said, swearing in French when Odette stabbed her with a pin.
"Sois immobile,"
Odette said through her teeth, then pulled out the pin.
"If you do not move, I do not prick you."
"She is a thorny rose," Sari said, sighing with relief when Odette sat back on her heels, surveyed her work.
"It will do," she said.
"Merci," Sari said, stepping off the platform and giving the dress a spin.
"It is beautiful, no?"
"It really is. Won't the veil thing get irritating?" Sari laughed.
"The ensemble is worth a bit of irritation."
"You look very vampiric," I said, "and very French." She smiled.
"Perhaps I will find a strong American vampire to teach me a thing or two."
"I wouldn't mention that to Marion. Are you ready to go?"
"Finishing touches,"
Odette said, adjusting the veil and fit of Sari's dress across the shoulders. Then she stood back, put her hands on her hips, and surveyed her creation.
"You are ready,"
she pronounced, and that was that. Where downtown Chicago had become sleeker, Hyde Park had stayed pretty much the same. But several of the older homes and mansions had been renovated and rejuvenated because peace brought new cachet to living next to vampires. Cadogan House looked the same as it had 4 years ago, a big, stately stone building with an arch over the front door and a widow's walk crowning the top, in the middle of a gorgeous lawn big enough to be a park. There was a tall fence around the perimeter, a new guardhouse at the gate. It had been my home for 19 years. I loved the building and the park that surrounded it, and I loved my parents and the other house vampires who'd become part of my supernaturally extended family. But I'd been ready to move on when I'd left for Paris, and leaving the fortified house had been part of that. I'd proven to myself that I could make it on my own, and coming home again made the house seem somehow smaller. Paparazzi waited outside the fence, but there were plenty of guards to keep them away from the gate. They were positioned every few feet, and I guess they had repeated that precaution all the way around the house. Unlike vampires, the humans opted for guns, and there were matte handguns strapped to their waists. Our autos rolled to a stop in front of the gate. A tuxedoed guard with a clipboard approached the first auto, opened the door, and checked their credentials, then assisted Marion onto the red carpet. Sari squeezed my hand.
"The house is lovely," she said, "just as you described."
She leaned forward to look out the window, take in the white lanterns that hung like moons over the cocktail tables that dotted the front lawn. The tables were decked with flowers. Servers bore trays of appetizers and crystal flutes of golden champagne in the balmy August air, beneath a brilliant waxing moon. Even in the vehicle, I could hear the hum of music from a jazz band, probably on the other side of the house. Our auto pulled up into the spot vacated by Marion's car, and the guard with the clipboard approached.
"Name?"
he asked, giving me a pleasant smile. "Elisa Sullivan, Seraphine, and guests." The guard had been looking down at a clipboard, and his head snapped back up quick enough. "Yes, I'm their kid," I said with a smile. "We're here for the party."
"Of course,"
he said, and stepped aside, offering a hand as I stepped out of the car and onto the sidewalk. The song grew louder, and the scents of wine and food and perfume added notes to the air. When we were all out of the vehicle, 8 vampires in assorted red carpet wear, he stepped aside and gestured grandly toward the sidewalk.
Have a lovely evening.
Thank you. Shutters began clicking, screens pointed in our direction as the paparazzi caught the scent of blood, and they focused on Sari. She had an amazing way of seeming to ignore them while presenting exactly the right angle to their cameras, just the right expression of not caring and demanding their attention. She worked the dress, too, using her shoulders and hips and legs to show off its strange angles, before sashaying toward the gate, Odette trailing behind her. There was a definite gleam in Sari's eye when she reached me.
There is a time for politics, she said, and a time for beauty.
I nodded, ignored the quickening of my heartbeat, the magical anticipation that rode beneath the skin. There was also a time for confrontation, and I had a feeling it would be sooner rather than later. Paris was beautiful, and Maison Dumas was gorgeous, but there was something to be said for Cadogan House in late summer, when the trees were full, the air smelled of smoke and meat, and the lawn glimmered with torches. The house's lawn was enormous, big as a park with walking trails, copses of trees, and benches placed just so to take advantage of the views. Vampires from more than a dozen countries were enjoying the balmy air, walking across the soft grass with champagne flutes in hand as jazz filled the air, accompanied by the heady scent of August flowers.
First, Sari said, a drink.
She glanced around the lawn. Ah, she said, and pointed toward a waiter with a silver tray. But when she began to walk in his direction, and I obediently moved to follow her, she stopped and held up a hand.
Elisa, you are dear to me, and while I would be happy to have your company this evening, this is the first time you've been home in years.
She put a hand on my arm.
You should take this opportunity to visit friends and family. I'm sure they have missed you.
I'm working, I reminded her. I'm your escort.
Odette will be with me.
She glanced around.
Besides, we are at your parents' home, surrounded by allies and guards. The talks proceeded without violence, if with a bit more drama than I'd have appreciated, and there's no reason to think there will be violence here tonight. Even if there was, there are plenty here to assist.
She squeezed the hand already on my arm.
There is no need to be concerned.
You're sure? I didn't mind a good party, but I didn't want to shirk my duties.
I am sure. I spoke with Marion as well, and we agreed you should be able to visit with your loved ones.
All right, I said, figuring I'd do both. I could enjoy the party, but stay within sight of Sari and Marion in case I needed to intervene. And she was right. The guards and vampires here were more than capable. In that case, I'll see you later. And I walked toward Cadogan House to face the monster again. 8. It had been 4 years, but Cadogan House smelled exactly the same, like wood polish and fresh flowers, the scent from the enormous vase of wildflowers on the pedestal table in the foyer. There were parlors off to each side, a curving oak staircase that led to the first floor, and a long central hallway that led to the cafeteria and offices. I walked to the pedestal table, let fingers trail across slick and smooth wood, and the memory crept into view like a photograph. I'd been 16, coming downstairs to the foyer to wait for Lulu. She was going to sleep over. I found Connor slouched on a wooden bench, back against the wall,
and long legs stretched out in front of him. He wore snug jeans and a t-shirt beneath a black moto-style jacket. His arms had been crossed over his chest, and his eyes were closed, so a fan of dark lashes brushed his cheeks. His hair had been longer than it was now, thick, dark locks that brushed his shoulders, and his lips had been curved in a smile. He'd looked, I'd thought, like a very wicked and happy angel.
"What's up, Brad?"
he'd asked, without opening his eyes. "Do you call all vampires Brat these days?" I'd asked, walking closer.
"I can smell your perfume."
I'd blinked. I'd worn the same fragrance for years, a pale pink liquid in a square bottle that smelled like spring flowers, but I'd never have thought he'd noticed.
"Wolf," he'd said, opening his eyes drowsily. "Predatory sense of smell."
"So you say. Making yourself at home?" I'd asked, nudging the toe of his boot.
"The pack's an ally," he'd said. "Aren't we supposed to make ourselves at home?"
"You want a drink and a snack plate, too? Maybe a blanket?"
"Sure,"
he'd said with a grin, sitting upright and clasping his hands between his knees.
"You going to get that for me?"
"Not in this lifetime." He'd actually clucked his tongue.
"That's poor vampire hospitality. And before you can interrogate me, Mini Sentinel, my dad's talking to yours. I'm waiting."
"Not interested enough in the pack to join in?" That had hit the mark, and something flashed in his eyes. But before he could answer, the front door had opened and Lulu had walked inside.
"What's up, other brat?"
"What's up, Labradoodle?"
She dropped her bag on the floor with a resounding thud. Connor had hated that name, which is exactly why Lulu used it. But his expression stayed the same, lazily confident.
"What will you two maniacs be doing tonight? Alphabetizing the books in the library?"
"At least we know how to alphabetize."
Gabriel had walked into the foyer, smiled when he'd seen us. Connor sat up straight, which had had me biting back a grin.
"Elisa? Lulu?"
I'd offered a wave.
"Hey, Mr. Keene."
He'd given me a wink, then looked at his son.
"Let's go, Con."
Connor had risen from the bench, offered us a salute as he'd followed his father outside again.
"At least you get Brat," Lulu had said when the door closed again. "You're the original. I'm the other."
She walked to one of the windows that flanked the door, watched the pair walk down the sidewalk.
"It's a damn shame he's such a punk, because he would be stupid hot if it wasn't for the attitude."
"Maybe," I'd said. That Connor Keene was gorgeous was undeniable. "But he'll always be a punk." 7 years later, I ran my fingers along the table, then headed for the staircase that led to the third floor. He was still hot, and maybe, surprisingly, a little less of a punk. The apartments, our home within Cadogan House, opened into a pretty sitting room. My parents' bedroom was to the left. To the right was the smaller suite they'd created for me. A bedroom, bathroom, and closet I'd learned later had been carved out of the hotel's consort suite. TMI, but there you go. I walked toward my bedroom, wondered if it would feel the same to be surrounded with stuff from another part of my life, or if everything would feel distant, strange. There was nothing pink, no photographs under the mirror, no freeze-dried roses or trophies. Striped bedspread, matching lamps on the nightstand, and a desk with everything arranged just so, which is how I'd liked it. A small table held the turntable I'd saved my allowance to buy, the vinyl organized alphabetically beneath it. A bookshelf held a few books and a lot of coffee mugs from my favorite spots in Chicago. There were mementos,
but they were organized in the scrapbooks on the second shelf. Plenty of photos of Lulu in those, occasional shots of Connor. Family trips to amusement parks and cities with enough nightlife to give us something to do when the sun was down. I walked back into the sitting room, and that's when I felt it. The katana, pulsing with magic, was only a few yards away. I knew it would be in the house, had hoped the fact that I hadn't sensed it the moment I'd walked in the door meant the calm I'd managed at the hotel was giving me the cushion I'd needed. But just like that first step into Chicago, I'd guessed wrong again. I was susceptible, vulnerable, and I didn't like being either. I moved closer, walking toward my parents' bedroom, and the magic pounded harder, so it felt like concert-worthy bass rattling the floor to a song I couldn't hear. But everything was still. The frames on the wall, the vase of flowers on the table, the inkwell on the secretary in the corner. I stepped over the threshold. The walls here were pale blue, the wood dark brown, the accents white and silver. The package of red brocade silk lay on my parents' bed, a shock of color across a crisply white duvet. It was tied with a braided and tasseled ivory silk cord, and it was close enough to touch. My mother had taken the sword out of the armory again, probably because of the fairy's interruption, and just in case she needed to protect the house. She wasn't wearing it tonight. The rest of the guards would be protecting the house, and I was part of the Dumas contingent, and she had diplomatic responsibilities. Magic throbbed in my chest, pulsing like a foreign heartbeat. I moved into the bedroom, untied the cord, and unwrapped the fabric, revealing the gleaming red scabbard. Visually, it looked exactly like what it was, a sheathed katana. There was nothing especially unusual about the lacquer or the cord around the handle, and I knew the blade would look well-crafted and lethally sharp. It was the magic that mattered, the power bound to the sword, and the trace of it that had bound itself inside me. I was here, alone with it. If there would be a reckoning, this was the time. So I squeezed my hands into fists, closed my eyes, and relaxed the mental barriers I'd erected against the magic's cries. They called to each other, not because they wanted to be bound together inside me or inside the sword, but because they wanted to be free, so they could spread their anger around the city. "Not going to happen," I gritted out. Its reaction was instant and painful. The monster lashed out, fury flashing across my skin like fire, hot enough to singe. I stumbled backward, reaching out to the wall behind me to steady myself, green silk pooling around me, my heartbeat racing as magic tried to fight back. I swallowed hard and bore down, then stood up again. "You aren't in charge," I said, and took a step forward. Anger spread again, and I breathed through pursed lips to deal with it, but tears still sprang to my eyes. "You don't own me," I said, taking another step forward and staring down at the inert metal. "And you never will. So do us both a favor and give up the fight." I'd come to say my piece, and I'd said it. It took the rest of my strength to wrap the scabbard in silk again, to knot the cords, to straighten the blanket beneath the package. That seemed important somehow, that the blanket was straight. I stepped back, the tightness in my chest easing up as I put distance between myself and the sword. But I could feel the pulse beneath my ribs, the refusal to give up. I'd won this battle, but the war would continue, and we'd all see who won. In the bathroom attached to my bedroom, I pressed a damp cloth against my neck until my heart had slowed and my eyes faded to green again,
until I felt like Elisa. Then I tossed the towel into the laundry and walked out of the room, giving the apartment one last look before I closed the door. The monster hadn't bothered me as a child, not until I'd been old enough, or it had been old enough, to reach for my attention. That wasn't true anymore. I wasn't entirely sure what I was going to do when my service for Maison Dumas was complete. I'd thought about it, and had nearly 9 months to keep thinking about it. But one thing seemed certain. I couldn't live in Cadogan House. Not while the magic lived here, too. My father's office was as elegant as the rest of his house. It held the carefully curated souvenirs of his life amid the pretty furniture, a desk, a conversation area with armchairs, and a long conference table where he could hash out issues with his staff. He sat at his desk, frowning at something on the sleek glass screen perched there. He wore a black tuxedo, perfectly fitted, his hair tied back at his nape. "Burning the midnight oil?" He smiled but kept his gaze on the screen.
"Just finishing up a project," he said, then swiped a finger against the glass and looked up at me. "And don't you look lovely?"
He rose, came over, and pressed a kiss to my forehead.
"My smart and kind and beautiful girl."
He liked to say that, had been saying it for years, and had always put beautiful last. Whether it was true or not, he'd tell me it was the least important of the three.
"You are smart," he'd say. "You should be kind. And if you are, you'll always be beautiful."
"Thank you. The house looks great. Luke did a very nice job getting things ready." Luke had been captain of the house's guards, and he'd been promoted when Malik became master of his own house. Kelly had taken over for Luke. My father grinned.
"He has an unusually good hand with decorations, and Kelly has done an excellent job in his stead on security."
"Do you think there'll be trouble tonight?"
"I don't know. The ombudsman's office doesn't believe so."
"And what do you believe?" A sly look crossed his face.
"I believe the issue is in their hands, and I trust them to handle the investigation. And in the meantime, we have guards posted in and around the house."
"So I saw." I looked around the room, at the mementos he'd chosen to keep in sight. A few stood on glossy white floating shelves under glass covers. "Do you ever miss it?"
"Miss what?"
he asked. "The adventures." He smiled, tucked his hands into his pockets.
"They didn't always feel like adventures. More often, they were terrifying or constraining or infuriating. It is hard to be an enemy, Elisa. It wears."
"And you're less of an enemy now?"
"It would be more accurate to say we don't involve ourselves in situations in which we could cause harm, even collaterally, to the city. And, more important, we found a different kind of adventure."
He smiled at me.
"But no less terrifying or infuriating."
"Is this your segue into the trials and tribulations of parenthood?" He raised a golden eyebrow, my dad's signature move. He'd scared off a couple of human boyfriends with that one.
"Fewer trials than tribulations, but yes. We wanted to be parents, and we wanted to keep you safe. We tried to do that."
He looked at me, considering.
"Have you given any thought to what you'd like to do after Paris?"
"I'm thinking about it," I promised.
"The house is always hiring," he said with a knowing smile. "And you have an inn with the master."
"No nepotism. We've talked about that. I earn my way or I don't." He walked toward me, took my hand.
"I didn't think I could be prouder of you, And then I saw you fighting at the Eiffel Tower for someone who wasn't able. That's who you are, Elisa. You just need to figure out what you'd like to do with it.
Am I interrupting?
We looked back and found Malik Washington in the doorway, wearing an impeccable navy suit, a gingham square tucked into the pocket. His skin was dark, his head shaved, his eyes pale green. Uncle Malik! We strode to each other, met in the middle. Congratulations on the house, I said as we embraced. And sorry I couldn't make it to the reception. He smiled.
Thank you. We appreciated the card and the macarons. They were truly excellent.
At least I'd gotten that present right. Paris is very good at macarons. How's life as a master?
There is, somehow, more paperwork. Vampires and bureaucracy are strange bedfellows.
So Dad always said. How's Aunt Aaliyah?
She's good. On a deadline.
She always is, I said with a smile, which he returned.
She sends her best, and hopes we can get together before you leave again.
That would be great, if you can keep the fairies and vampires in line.
We'll do our best, he said earnestly. How are you? How is Paris?
I'm good, and Paris is great. I pointed to the ceiling. It's been a while since I was upstairs, so I gave the apartments a walkthrough.
That must be a very strange feeling, to walk through your childhood room.
It was odd, was all I'd admit to. Since I'd faced down my old monsters, it was time to go watch the new ones. Leaving my father and Uncle Malik to talk, and leaving my katana in his office for safekeeping, I took the house's main hallway through the cafeteria, which was empty given the spread on the lawn, and out onto the brick patio that stretched in a half moon along the back of the house. Urns of white flowers scented the air, and while there was an abundance of magic along with it, the mix stifled the thrumming of my mother's sword, so I wasn't about to complain. Vampires and other supernaturals strolled in the grass and near the long buffet table set up a few dozen yards away, near an oak tree whose branches nearly skimmed the ground. I found Sari and Marion speaking with Scott Gray and Morgan Greer, Chicago's other two masters, who laughed as they watched the screen Scott held out. Probably puppy videos. Even vampires liked puppy videos. Having confirmed they were safe and sound, I looked for the waiter with the champagne I'd seen earlier. I'd earned a little relaxation. And I turned to face down a wolf, albeit one in human clothes. Connor stood behind me in a black tux that enhanced every bit of hard and sleek muscle and seemed to make his blue eyes glow. One dark lock curled across his forehead, and a day's growth of stubble darkened his jaw. He looked, somehow, even more dangerous, even more wicked. That probably suited his escort just fine. Tabby stood beside him, gorgeous again tonight in a gold sequin dress with a deep V-neck and long sleeves that reflected sparks of light across her amazing face and carved cheekbones.
Hello,
Connor said. Hello. I shifted my gaze to his girlfriend. And hello.
Brett, this is Tabby.
Hey, Tabby said, fingers tangling in a lock of Connor's hair in a way that looked more irritating than seductive. And the expression on her face was one of absolute boredom. It's nice to meet you. Your magic at the reception was impressive.
Just part of what we do.
She dropped her hand, propped it on her hip.
I want something to drink. You?
She asked, glancing at Connor. He held up a beer.
I'm good.
I'll be back,
she said, then kissed him lavishly and slunk toward the bar.
She is really beautiful, I said,
It was the only compliment I could think of, and I didn't think, "She seems super comfy with PDA," would come off very well. Not that it would have been intended to.
"She is,"
Connor said, and we watched as the waiter offered her a short glass of amber alcohol. She downed it, held the glass out for another. And when a vampire approached the bar for a drink, she snapped her teeth at him in a show of ferocity? Beautiful, but maybe not very classy.
"That's not leather."
I shifted my gaze back to Connor. "What?"
"Your dress. It's not leather, but I still like it. Green's a good color on you."
"Thank you," I said slowly, suspicious at the compliment. "I like the tux." He shifted his shoulders with obvious discomfort.
"Suits are for humans and vampires."
"You're pulling it off just fine, and you know you look good in it." The words were out before I knew I'd said them, and the surprised look on his face said he'd noticed. "I should probably dial that back, or your ego will be out of control. Let's say you look acceptable for a shifter."
"But not quite as good as a vampire."
I just grinned at him. "I don't want to insult you at my ancestral home," he snorted.
"This is a good shindig for a vampire party."
"It is nice," I agreed. "What would a shifter party look like?"
"Leather, like you said. Muscles, cleavage, thrashing guitar, broken beer bottles, supernaturals thrown through plate glass windows, axe-throwing contests."
"That was a thing?" He squinted as he remembered.
"Couple of years ago, Berna decided the bar tables looked too new. They pulled a few off the bases, hung the tabletops, and threw axes at them."
He took a drink.
"They did look better afterward. She has a good eye."
"The bar looks good," I said, "but the floor's too clean."
"If you only knew how many conversations we've had about that. I keep threatening to roll Thelma out there, change the oil right in the bar floor."
"But you don't, because Berna terrifies you?"
"I admit nothing."
He smiled, his eyes crinkling at the corners. He was in a better mood now than he had been earlier today. Maybe it was the date or the booze, or just the fact that he was at a party instead of thinking about the pack's future and the enemies he might meet on the way to Alaska. Whatever the reason, I liked seeing him like this.
"What?"
he asked, eyes narrowed. "Nothing. Just thinking that you're in a good mood."
"Am I not usually?"
"Not in my direction," I said with a grin. Connor cocked an eyebrow at something behind me. I looked back, found Riley grinning as he carried a 3-foot-high stack of aluminum trays toward a buffet table. He'd also worn a tuxedo, and it was working just as hard as Connor's to hold in the muscle and magic. He'd pulled his hair back into a man bun, and it showed off the interesting lines and angles of his face.
"You're staring," Connor said.
"He's worth it," I said, and grinned back at him. "Does it bother you that you're the second prettiest shifter these days?" His gaze narrowed dangerously, and that made my blood race a little harder. Probably some ancient vampire reaction to shifters.
"I'm neither pretty nor second place for anything."
"Mm-hmm. You're plain and retiring, as every man in want of a wife should be." This time, he grunted.
"I'm not in want of a wife."
"All tabby to the contrary. Doesn't the pack want you to have a partner?" I frowned, trying to remember. "Isn't there something in the code about the Apex being married?" They might have liked the rock and roll lifestyle, but shifters had pretty conservative opinions about relationships. It was related, or so Connor said, to their relationship to the Earth, and the belief that even an alpha occasionally needed a second opinion. Shifters partnered with shifters, and generally of the same animal variety, although Gabriel's Aunt Fallon had loosened that rule when she'd married a shifter who transformed into a white tiger.
"I'm not Apex," he said. "Yet."
There was a high whistle, then a ringing of silver against crystal. All eyes turned to my father, who stood beside my mother, also in sleek Cadogan black, an off-the-shoulder column that skimmed the ground, with long fitted sleeves of black lace on tulle, on the brick patio at the edge of the house. The crowd quieted, turned to face him.
"I don't want to interrupt the party," he said. "I just wanted to take this opportunity to express our gratitude for the steps you've taken tonight toward a lasting peace. The road to that peace will not be easy. It will not be smooth. But it is worth the effort."
He lifted his glass.
"To peace."
"To peace," the crowd echoed.
"And I'd be remiss," he continued, "if I didn't mention how proud we are to have our daughter home once again, even if for a little while."
I smiled politely at the supernaturals who all turned to stare at me.
"Just imagine the rest of the crowd is naked," Connor murmured behind me. "It'll help."
Spoiler alert, it didn't. 9. Eventually, my father moved on, and the guests' attention went back to the food and drink and other guests. Theo walked toward us with a woman in a long-sleeved dress of emerald green. Her skin was tan, her hair dark and straight with golden highlights, her eyes wide and dark under long, dark brows.
"Hey, Elisa," Theo said.
"Hey. Theo, do you know Connor Keen?"
"Sure,"
Theo said and stuck out his free hand.
"I mean, I don't think we've met officially, but I know who you are. Good to meet you."
"Theo works for the Ombudsman's office," I said. I glanced at the woman he was with, and memories fired. She seemed familiar, but it wasn't until I saw she wore satin gloves in the same shade as the dress that I realized why. "Oh my God," I said. "Petra!" She smiled and held up a hand.
"Hey, Elisa."
"I barely recognized you."
"Yeah, I got a lot taller," she said with a smile. "My dad's 6'2". And it's been like," she lifted her gaze, counting to herself, "8 years?
"About that," I said, then looked at Theo and Connor. "Petra and I were tutored together until she moved. Wyoming, wasn't it?"
"Wisconsin," she said. "Dad's an accountant with a big firm. We got transferred.
And we hadn't done a very good job of keeping in touch with each other. Are you back in Chicago now?"
"Have been for about a year."
"That's great. How's the aromancy gig?"
"Aromancy?"
Connor asked, brows lifted. Petra turned her wide smile to him. "I can commune with the weather. Hear it, influence it a little. Lightning and I have a unique relationship." "Thus the gloves," I said, and she nodded.
"That's frightening and impressive," Connor said, which I figured was about the correct reaction. "Can I see?"
"Sure," Petra said, and pulled off a glove. "Hold out your hand, palm up." It made me smile that our brave and muscled shifter hesitated before offering his right hand. She put her ungloved fingers over his, then blew out a slow breath, and a brilliant blue spark sizzled between their hands.
"Shit,"
Connor said, eyes widening as he was literally shocked by power.
"How cool is that?"
Theo asked enthusiastically.
"It's pretty fucking cool,"
Connor said, looking at the palm of his hand, then rubbing the skin. "Injuries?" Petra asked, putting her glove back on.
"No, not at all," he said, lifting his gaze to hers. "It was a little like shifting, the same sizzling power, but concentrated."
And that's one of the reasons why Dearborn hired her, Theo said. She's also an assistant ombudsman, head of the tech crew.
Small world, I said. Although it had been a long time since I'd known Petra, she'd been smart, funny, and kind. That she worked for the OMB, as Theo called it, made me feel a lot better about Dearborn being in charge.
Speaking of small worlds, Theo said, did you get a load of the panther?
He gestured toward the woman currently draped on William Dearborn.
Or maybe a cougar would have been more accurate.
I just managed not to choke, given the woman was Tabby.
That's Connor's date, I said with a very forced smile. Well, she seems...
Theo faltered, obviously grasping for a compliment. Then he shook his head, apparently giving up.
Like something you could improve upon?
He offered to Connor.
She's vivacious.
She's vivating all over the ombudsman, Petra said dryly.
It's fine, Connor said.
His voice had tightened, and I wasn't sure if that was because he was irritated by the activity or our questions about it. And it wasn't, frankly, any of our business, any more than Tabby's sex life was.
You're a good-looking man, Theo said appraisingly. I go for chicks, but I'm sure there are plenty of ladies who'd be interested in you and have a little more to offer in terms of loyalty.
He looked at me speculatively.
You're single, aren't you, Elisa?
No, Connor and I said simultaneously, and with just as much emphasis, which wasn't flattering to either of us. Not my type, I said with a mirthless smile.
Not even in the same universe, Connor agreed.
And I have a girlfriend. He sipped his drink.
Oh, okay, Theo said. Your protestations are totally convincing.
He looked at me with a grin.
Do you have any hobbies, Elisa? What do you do for fun?
She doesn't, Connor said. Sick burn, puppy, I said. Just because I don't party 24/7 doesn't mean I don't have hobbies.
Is it stamp collecting?
No.
Do you literally watch grass grow?
As my irritation grew, my eyes silvered, and I let him see it.
Come at me, brat.
Seriously, Petra said with a nod. You two are very cute. Connor actually growled, and it was time to change the topic. I have hobbies. Yoga, and there's martial arts training, katana practice, blah blah blah. It's hard to find time to just do things. I think I'd like to learn calligraphy. Connor blinked.
That is not what I'd have expected you to say.
I shrugged. I like letters. They're very...
orderly?
He asked with a grin. When you're facing down immortality, I said, order is important. Rules are comforting.
Rules are constricting, he countered.
My parents are aromancers, Petra said, and hobbies are hard when you're the kid of a sub. There are expectations. I thought of the discussion I'd had with Lulu, how our parents' abilities had affected us. No disagreement here.
I played baseball as a kid, Connor said. Third base, and had a fantastic arm.
He flexed his biceps, and the muscles strained against the slick fabric.
But the old man wanted me at Little Red, at the house, at wherever the pack happened to be. So that was the end of that. Pack comes first. Always.
I don't understand the point of baseball. Theo looked at me, blinked.
What do you mean you don't understand the point of it? What's to understand? It's a sport.
If there's time for the players to have snacks, it's not a sport. It's recess. Connor rolled his eyes.
Seeds aren't a snack.
Agree to disagree, I said, holding up a hand and was glad to finally speak my truth about baseball. My mother was a Cubs fan, so dissent had not been allowed in Cadogan House. But I understand your point. I took piano lessons until it was time to take katana lessons.
Didn't you hate piano lessons? Petra asked.
I did, I said with a smile, impressed that she'd remembered. With a passion. I like music, but I can't make it. And my teacher, Mrs. Velichnik. God, I hated her. She was like the villain from a Victorian orphan story.
They just wanted us to be prepared, Connor said, for, you know, Juilliard or supernatural warfare.
I know.
I'm actually feeling moderately better about growing up human, Theo said. I figured it was boring. Homework, anime, baseball and basketball, trips to Challengers Comics to grab the new releases. Maybe I had it easy. I wouldn't say human is easy either, Connor said. Mortality, illness, bullies. Being a sup makes those things easier, at least some of the time. Except when it doesn't. Except when it makes life harder.
I froze, shocked into silence by the possibility that he was going to say it aloud, talk about my monster, the evidence he'd seen. But he didn't even look at me, just brushed his shoulder against mine. It was so light, so casual, that I wasn't sure if he'd done it on purpose, an acknowledgement that he'd felt the magic that accompanied my fear, or if it was accidental.
Well, if it isn't Elisa Sullivan.
I turned back. The vampire behind me was handsome, with wavy, blonde-brown hair that nearly reached his shoulders and was tucked behind his ears. Tall and muscular, with broad shoulders that narrowed to a tapered waist. He wore a pale gray suit over a white button-down, and he'd skipped the tie.
Welcome back to Chicago, Elisa, he said, and pressed a kiss to my cheek.
His accent was British, and his name was something with a D. Darren? David?
Dane, he said. Gray House.
I made the introductions, ending with Connor.
Of course, Dane smiled. The Prince of Wolves. Not exactly, he said.
He sipped his drink, watching me over the rim.
How do you two know each other?
We met before I went to Paris, I said.
You wound me, Elisa,
Dane said with a grin, putting a hand over his heart.
We had dinner shortly before she left.
The memory, or what there was of it, clicked into place. There'd been a dinner I didn't much remember. I'd liked his accent and his sarcasm, and hadn't given anything else much thought. I'd also been focused on Paris, and not especially interested in dating a vampire who looked my age, but was decades older.
How did you find Paris?
He asked. Halfway between X and Y. Connor grinned. Dane's smile was a little more forced. It was lovely and complicated, I said.
Sounds like Chicago,
Dane said, then looked at Connor.
I understand the pack's leaving us soon. Heading back to Alaska, are you?
Some of us, Connor said.
Of course. Shame to leave now when things are getting interesting.
Interesting? Connor asked.
After years of peace, I mean. The fairies bursting into the peace talks. The violence in Europe.
He looked at me.
There are many videos of your heroism at the Eiffel Tower. You handled yourself well. It was impressive.
The sudden flash of interest in his eyes, that deeper ring in his voice, didn't win him the points he probably thought they would. I hadn't been trying to play hero. I hadn't been playing at all, and neither had the vampires who'd attacked. It was what needed to be done. Dane seemed surprised I hadn't taken the bait, hadn't been flattered by his approval, and Connor looked pleased by my answer. As if looking for an exit, Dane waved at someone across the yard.
Well, I should make the rounds. Good seeing you again, Lise.
He squeezed my hand, making me think I'd been downgraded from the kiss on the cheek, and walked away.